This is Playing with Fire. He's at the 20, the 10, the 5. Touchdown!
3 seconds remaining. 2-1. Shots up. It's good!
Here's the pitch, the swing. It's a long fly ball. It's going, going, it's gone! Revealing the secrets of the elite athlete. But be careful, you're playing with fire.
Freestyle.
Hey everybody, you're tuned into Playing with Fire, and I'm your host, Dr. Bill Thierfelder. How are you doing today? We have a great show ahead. We're going to be dealing with reading and reacting, team building, the spiritual combat, and much more. So let's get going. Listen up.
Well, welcome everybody to Playing with Fire. We have a great interview today. A gentleman that I've gotten to know over the past several years. I'm not going to embarrass him too much today on this introduction, but he's just really an awesome individual in all ways. When you talk about a fully rounded, balanced man of, faith, integrity, intellect, just real skill. And his name is Steve Lukewire, and he is the president of Lukewire George Andrews Incorporated, which is the leading advertising and public relation agency in the Charlotte. They're located in the Charlotte city of Charlotte, but they span the entire country, and I'm sure they even do some international work as well. And they have capitalized annual billings of more than $70 million. The agency provides integrated marketing and branding services for nationally and internationally recognized, recognized companies on the New York Stock Exchange, such as Curtis-Wright Controls, Blum Inc. They're also doing work with the National Football League's Carolina Panthers, Time Warner Cable, the Wachovia Championship, a PGA Tour event, and TIAA Cref. LGA, as it's fondly, I guess, shortened to, was founded in 1984 by Steve Lukewire and Tom George and Clay Andrews. And the agency has been recognized with numerous industry awards, including the Andy Awards, which is presented by the American Advertising Federation, the Grand Award at the New York International Film and Video Festival, and Print and Design Excellence Award. And we're just blessed and fortunate to have Steve Lukewire with us today. So, Steve, I just want to welcome you to the program.
Thank you so much, Bill. That's a nice introduction. I'll need to get a copy and send that to my mother.
I knew. He's also a humble man, I must tell you, and so I know it's going to embarrass him, but let me jump into this. One thing, what I try to do with this program is bring people on that are at a national level or international level who have been very successful, but in maybe some different angles on sport. As we, try to address these questions about sport and virtue, are they compatible and how so? I'd just like if you could tell everybody a little bit about, what's it like to run a marketing and advertising campaign for a professional sports team or organizations or individuals?
Well, I think as we approach sports in business, we don't separate the sports from being a business because, frankly, fans quite often don't look at it as a business, and I think that's why they're fans. But when you work with professional sports teams, PGA events, college franchises, et cetera, it is an incredibly large business, and I think you can't ever lose sight of that, Bill.
Yeah, is it something though? Like when you're working, are you kind of a bridge in a sense between? Because you're reaching out to all of us, who are seeing how the team or the league is presenting themselves in a sense to the world. And what goes into doing that?
Well, I think that's a good point because more times than not, professional teams or even college teams don't want to be perceived as businesses because it breaks down the bond between the fan and the team. And so I think we're always very careful in how we try to position the teams. Teams are no different than other business brands. They have a brand. They have a culture. And that is how the public perceives that particular entity. And so it is critical that professional sports teams always are very careful in the manner in which they present themselves. And I think it quite often starts at the very top of the franchise with the owner and the president. And the teams, more times than not, mirror the image of the owner.
Well, maybe I'll jump right into that then, because you've worked quite a bit with Jerry Richardson of the Carolina Panthers, and I wonder if you could tell us a little bit about what's that been like and what you've just said. How does he kind of fit into that?
Well, Mr. Richardson is an incredibly persuasive individual. He defines his expectations for the entire organization, not just the players, not just the 53 players on the team, but the balance of the staff, the coaching staff, training staffs. Everyone understands. There's no gray area. And his expectations, he once simplified it for me, and he told me on game day, he asked me what I thought about the concept that they didn't allow fans to go shirtless, take their shirts off. And he said, what do you think about that? I said, I think it's a great idea. And I said, how did you come to make that decision? How did you draw that line? He says, well, frankly, what I do is I look at it and I think, if that's not the environment that I would want my grandchildren to be in or be exposed to, then I don't think it's right for the rest of our fans. And so, it simplifies the concept, but he cares very much about the presentation and the environment in which all fans will view the football game, and I applaud him for it.
See, that's a great, great insight that I know myself, and I'm sure many people listening to this would never have imagined, but it's great to hear that somebody is kind of thinking in a virtuous way and actually taking action on it and doing some of the things. And the fact that you don't see it, you don't realize it perhaps, but it's great that he has that kind of awareness and that kind of commitment to making sure that it is a family environment. That's just wonderful.
Well, I think it seems simplistic, but when you break it down to that lowest common denominator, it makes so much sense. And unfortunately, we quite often get caught up in so many details that we can't see the forest or the trees. And I think Mr. Richardson, he's been around sports all of his life. There have only been two NFL owners that have played in the NFL. They were George Halas and Jerry Richardson, who later went on after playing to own NFL franchises. And so he's a rare individual who understands the game on the field as well as in the stands, and he is a phenomenal business person. So he is a virtuous man. He cares greatly about how the team affects the Carolinas and the perception that the fans have about the team. And having gone through now, we're kind of moving into our second generation of Carolina Panther fans. You're starting to see younger kids. The kids now that are in high school, that's the Carolina Panthers are the only team they've known since they were in kindergarten. So that type of culture is starting to grow roots, and I think that the Panthers will be a beneficiary as well as the Carolinas.
Well, that's a great insight, because sometimes when you hear about this vice stuff, where you see all the bad stuff coming out about players doing this and that and the other thing, and the attitudes and all these kinds of things exist, you sort of assume that everybody's complicit with it. You're thinking, well, all the teams go along with that, and all the owners go along with that, I guess, and I guess they have to say they don't, but they really do. But it seems that Mr. Richardson has the respect of the players, at least whether they want to give it up begrudgingly or not, but they've got to respect him. He's played and he's been super successful in other ways. So does that help as far as specifically with the Carolina Panthers as maybe opposed to some of the other teams?
Oh, I think they view him as a peer as it relates to his playing career. I mean, he played and won a national championship. So I think that goes a long way in the support that he receives from his team. The Panthers early on, they weren't quite as lucky, and they had some issues related to player conduct. Mr. Richardson dealt with it very directly, And in fact, interestingly enough, he and Dan Rooney of the Pittsburgh Steelers were the co-chairs in the selection process for the new commissioner, Roger Goodell. And I think it's been huge news across the country as to how Commissioner Goodell has gone about dealing with player conduct. And so I think that's a direct result of Mr. Richardson and Mr. Rooney and some of the other owners who understand that to protect that their brand, they have to approach it from a little more virtuous perspective.
What's hot? Well, today I'm talking about a movie. Again, you know, I must have a soft spot for these true stories. I'm always picking out true stories, whether it's books or movies. I guess I'm inspired by them because I know they really happened. And so if it's an amazing story or it's something incredible, you know that it wasn't just somebody's imagination. It really did happen. But the movie, and I'm sure most of you probably have seen it at this point, is called The Rookie. And it's a great story. I believe it was put out by Disney. But one of the interesting things in the beginning of this, for me at least, was you see these nuns walking across sort of a dusty, deserty-looking Texas landscape, and they're sprinkling these yellow petals. And you know, some people may wonder what is that about? You know, you heard about the Saint Rita thing, and I think the well is actually named something Rita. And so people are probably wondering what is that about? And I thought I would just share a little bit of that with you, so you'd know who Saint Rita of Cassia really was. She was born, I believe it was in about 1381. That's going back quite a ways. And she's known as the patroness of the impossible. And I think that's why it, kind of fits in with this movie pretty well. But the I'll explain to you the rose petals in a second. But she actually wanted to become a religious. She wanted to actually become a nun. And her parents at the time didn't approve of that and sort of insisted that she get married. And so she did. Her husband, unfortunately, was murdered in a very tragic way. And she had two sons. And the two sons were going to avenge their father. And Rita was a very devout, holy woman, praying to God, daily, often, and prayed that her two sons would not do this because she knew that they'd lose their souls if they ended up acting out of revenge and going back and maybe trying to kill someone else in revenge for their father. And so she prayed that God would resolve this, and in an amazing turnaround, the two sons actually died almost immediately of natural causes, which is sort of remarkable. And so now with her husband and two sons having died, she actually went on to become a nun. She went into a religious order. And she had some remarkable, visions. And one of the things that she contended with all her life was actually sharing in one of the thorns of Christ, And so rose petals, when she was dying, she had asked that, she only asked for one thing, that, someone could bring her a rose from her home. And what was interesting is it was January, I believe, and it wasn't the time of year that roses were out, but somebody went to her home and found one rose bush. It was a completely barren bush except for one rose on it, yellow rose. And so they brought that to her, and that's why she's sort of tied together with those rose petals, as you may have seen. And so the story goes on that there were these two nuns, and they invested what little money they had in this oil well. When they went back and told the, the parish priest about it, he said, well, can you get your money back? And they said, no, it's too late. And he said, well, go pray to St. Rita. And that's what they did. And so they dedicated the well and the land to St. Rita's patronage and her intercession with our Lord. And so that's really where the story comes from. And the rest of the story, again, if you haven't seen it, is great. It's a real-life story about Jimmy Morris, who was a professional baseball pitcher with the Texas Rangers, and how he came to be such. It deals with a relationship with his dad, which was very, difficult most of his life. It deals with priorities in life, wife, children, his students. He was a teacher before becoming a professional pitcher. And, it talks about discernment, and how to do the right thing in the right situation. And so it's a great story. It has some good lessons in it, and so I'd recommend it to you. I hope you enjoy it. Praying Twice. Maybe it was the movie The Rookie, but I listened to this song. It's called Back Home, and it's by Syd, S-Y-D, and it made me think of, you know, family and our desire sometimes just to get back home, and so I hope you enjoy it. Well, that was Syd with Back Home, and you can find it on GarageBand.com, or you can check it on our show notes at ReclaimTheGame.com. It's your call. I recently had a question that said, what advice do you have for me as I prepare for a really big major golf tournament at the end of this month? Well, the first thing I'd say to you is, get rid of the words really big major. That's the problem. Up till now, you've been playing golf. And I once worked with a woman on the LPGA Tour, and I remember the same kind of thing. She was playing really very, very well. And, you know, for her ability, she was really performing well. And it was like a week away, 2 weeks away was the U.S. Open. And she said, "Now this is the really big one, you know." And I said to her, "Wait a second. They still play that on grass?" She said, "Yeah." I said, "And you get to use your clubs?" And she said, "Yeah." And I said, "And they still play with a white ball?" "Yeah." And I said, "They still have holes in the ground?" "Yeah." So, I mean, she got my point. I was driving her mad with that. But, you know, my point was, you know, to some degree, it's no different. Now, somebody may say, well, is there any value to competition then? If it doesn't matter, you know, whether I go out there on a practice round or I go out there for the U.S. Open, Well, yeah, the way you could think about competition, I described it before. Dennis Whitley has a nice way of talking about it. Was it Dennis Whitley? I might be wrong on that. It might be Timothy Galway who wrote, what was it, The Inner Game of Tennis or The Inner Game of Golf. But the analogy that was used was that of a surfer, and it was saying that, you know, if you're a world-class surfer and you're on two-foot waves, it doesn't take anything from you. There's nothing that is required in your ability to go out there and be on a two-foot wave. However, if you go to Australia or Hawaii or someplace where you're on, 30-foot waves, it's going to take everything out of you and more than you even knew, because it's going to put you in some positions. It's going to force you to react in ways that on the two-foot wave, you just don't have that opportunity. And so you can think of competition as being kind of a bigger wave. It's an opportunity for your skills, talents, and abilities to come out. So I would tell you that get rid of the idea. The reason I say get rid of the words big and major is because you're not thinking of it as a big wave that's going to pull out, great things out of yourself. You're seeing it as something that's, it's awesome and big and terrible and somehow going to get you. And I would just say to you, look, you focus on the task at hand. The skills that got you to this, quote, really big major golf tournament are the skills that you want to have when you're actually out there playing in it. And so by saying really big and major begins to change how you even approach what you're doing, and suddenly you're out there playing with skills at a lower level than you're really capable of, because you're not focused on what got you there. So stick with what you're doing, what the skills that you have right now, continue to master those and work on those, and when you get to the, quote, really big major tournament, just go out, take one ball at a time, play ball to ball, and before you know it, you'll be done, and hopefully your best result will have come out. So look forward to hearing more from you. Give me your feedback. You can call us on our listener line at 206-203-1301, or you can write to me at feedback@reclaimthegame.com. And I will ask you to go to our website, the www.reclaimthegame.com, and to vote on our Sport of the Service of the Spirit Award. We're looking to nominate a person for this next award, and I'd love to get your input. So hope you'll get to that soon.
Skills and drills.
Sometimes these drills that I talk about, this is kind of coming under the physical section. And the next section, Iron Will, is where I talk about some of the mental. But, sometimes with these things, it's hard to separate them out, because obviously you're mind, body, and spirit, all at one point. There's no separating them really. So sometimes I can talk about it by emphasizing something. But I want to make clear that what I'm about to talk about is obviously dealing with your mind, but it's also dealing with the way your body moves. And so I'm going to be talking a little bit about both of them here. But the concept is read and react. Read and react. And it's a skill that's really very important in most sports. It's your ability to see what's going on and then quickly react to it. And so one of the drills that I came up with some time ago when I was working with some pro quarterbacks was how to work with them when you're not in a real live situation where you don't have, real defense, real offense in front of you. How can you continue to work on some of your skills in terms of, reading the field? Like a quarterback has to go through a progression. In other words, on a given offensive play, there may be, three, four, five different outlets for that individual, and he needs to be able to go through those instantly. And one of the important things for a quarterback is that people think that a quarterback is sort of looking at things and seeing them, sort of develop over time. So he's watching that first receiver run his route and go out. No, NFL quarterbacks, think of it more like a Polaroid. In other words, their skill level is so high that what they're able to do is at an instant of time. So as the ball is snapped, they look out at the field, and in that instant, they can see on their number one progression who they're going to go to first, their primary receiver, and if it was pass play, they instantly know whether that person is going to be open or not. They quickly then shift to two, to three, to four, to five. And remember now, this is going to happen in less than 4 seconds for sure. Otherwise, this person's sacked or something not good is going to happen. So that means in a matter of seconds, a couple of seconds, a quarterback has to be able to go through his entire progression if necessary. I mean, sometimes that first person's open so he can get the ball to them. But that's a remarkable ability to be able to read and react in that way. And so one of the drills I came up with, especially when you're off season, you don't have the opportunity to be with a team, but you want to work on this skill, is we used actually kind of a net that we just hung down off a goalpost, and I put up three numbers, a one, a two, and a three, or sometimes I'd put up colors. I'd put up blue, green, and red, and I'd put those below the numbers. And then I'd have him, you know, go back to a line of scrimmage that might be, let's say, 20 yards from that net. And then we would work on different drops, like a three-step drop, you know, five-step drop. And basically what I would do then is I would call out the number. So if I said one, he would, like, pivot his feet quickly, boom, be in a position ready to throw the ball. And he would only throw a ball to the spot that I called out twice in a row. So if I said one, three, two, three, one, one, he would then throw to one. But on each of those calls, he had to spin and be ready to throw to each one of those. So you can imagine how fast his head and his feet and his eyes are moving towards these targets. And, you know, sometimes I change up, you know, and then we do colors, you know, like blue, green, blue, red, blue, blue. And then he'd have to hit blue. And the idea was, how fast could he release the ball to that spot? How well was he positioned, his technique, and then how accurate was the throw? Did he actually hit the spot? And you can take that drill and actually also apply it to, let's say, a point guard in basketball. You can set up, you know, kind of targets on a court. Somebody can come down, they can call out, you know, the same kind of thing and have you flash, 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 boom, and then pass a ball to that spot. And that's one way to work on this. Another is to watch some film. And what you can do is stop the film at the beginning of a play, at just as the play is starting to develop, and ask yourself, where would I go? Where would I go? Who's going to be open on this play? Then move a little bit further and see, was it accurate? And what you'll start to find is that you're able to see earlier and earlier in the play where the play should go, where the ball should go. And hopefully that can help you, and look forward to you trying that out. Iron Will. Today I wanted to touch on something, the idea of team building, relationships, and so forth. And, you know, sometimes when you think of team building, it's a lot of rah, 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 and we're all in it together kind of thing. But that's not really how relationships get formed. And I thought I'd just maybe touch on it a little bit and give you a couple of examples of things, then maybe challenge you to do something. The first is, what does it take to have a relationship whether you're on a team or not? You know, I'm married. So, you know, what does it take to have a marriage? And sometimes people think of these relationships as sort of being a 50-50 thing, almost like a business partnership. You know, like, you do your part, I'll do my part. And I will tell you that that never works. And the reason for that is, I don't know if you can visualize this in front of you, but if I put my arms up in front of me and made two fists, and I put the two fists together, picture the length of my arm from my fist to my elbow of each arm as being the 50-50 contribution of each person. Well, what if one day that person doesn't have 50% to give? What if they're at 30%? Well, the other person might be given their 50, but the other person's at 30, which means I'm going to pull my fist away from the other one. We're not connected anymore. What you have to be in a relationship is 100% for the other person. If you want to have a true relationship with somebody, you got to be willing to give 100%. In order to do that, that requires humility. That requires gratitude, which we've talked about before. And it requires sacrifice, which is love. Without being willing to give, and give with nothing, you're not looking for anything in return. That's a hard part about a relationship. Sometimes we're saying, well, I want something out of it. Well, then you don't really want a relationship. You want a partnership, like you want a business deal or something, you know? That's why so many of those fail, by the way. And by the way, that's why so many marriages fail today, because too many people are looking at it like it's a business relationship. So to have a true relationship, even on a team, it's about giving 100%. It's about giving to the other person because you choose to, not because of what they're going to give back to you. And sometimes we get affected by other people, and I thought I'd just give you this one little example. Let's say you and I knew each other, and we know each other's first names. We don't know much else about each other. We just know each other's first names, and we're at school or at work, wherever it might be, and we're walking down the hall. I look you right in the eye, and I say, hi, Bob. And Bob looks me right in the eye and just walks right by me. Ooh, you know, what's your first thought? Well, your first thought is, well, what a... kind of, I'll say the word, you know, what a jerk, you know, for doing that is usually your first reaction. But you think, well, okay, maybe he was busy, maybe he was distracted or something. So next time down the hall, here comes Bob. You're walking down the hall, you look him right in the eye, you say, hey, Bob. And then he looks at you and then walks right past you. Well, now you are confirmed that the guy's a jerk. And so you just say, fine, he wants to be that way. And so what ends up happening? Well, what ends up usually happening is you stop saying hello to Bob. But let's examine this for a second. If we know each other's name, you know Bob's name, and Bob knows your name, and you look him right in the eye, and he doesn't say hello to you, he's got a problem. There's something wrong with him. But who changes? Ooh, we're the ones who change because we stop saying hello. Matter of fact, we become like Bob. We said Bob's a jerk for not saying hello. Now we look at him in the eye from this point forward, and we don't say hello. So we've become like Bob. Well, why'd we do that? Why do we allow ourselves to be changed by somebody that we don't even think is doing the right thing? So what I challenge you to do is next time you meet somebody or see somebody who you know their name and they don't say hello to you, keep saying hello to them. And I guarantee you, it may take a while, but I guarantee you if you keep saying hello to that person, so every time you go by, hey, Bob, oh, Bob, hey, Bob, how's it going today? Hi, Bob. You keep doing that, what's going to eventually happen is that Bob is going to finally acknowledge you. At some point, Bob will go, huh. He may grunt at you, but he's going to acknowledge you, and he may actually say hello. And so now you've affected Bob, and that's something that you want to do in life. You want to be the person, you want to be the kind of people that affect others in your life, and hopefully for the good. So I'm going to leave you with one thing, maybe something practical to do. The hallway might be a practical thing to do. But after a game, very often, I see this like handshaking thing that goes on at the end. And I'm like, what is the point of that? You know, people are walking down the line. They're not even really shaking hands. They're touching it. Nobody really cares. I want you to try something. Next time you're in a game and you line up to shake hands at the end of the game, I want you to look each player in the eye. Each one. Don't race down that line. Look each player in the eye. Firmly shake their hand and then say something like, thanks, I learned a lot, or thanks, good game, whatever you want to say, but make sure that person saw your eyes and you acknowledged them and you said something positive to them, and then walk down the line. Now that means something. And by the way, that person may not remember much about that game, but they're going to remember shaking your hand.
Soul food.
I thought I'd talk a little bit about a really enjoyable book. At least I thought it was enjoyable. It's called The Spiritual Combat, and it's by Dom Lorenzo Scupoli, S-C-U-P-O-L-I. And it says, The Spiritual Combat and a Treatise on Peace of the Soul. And this was a favorite book of St. Francis de Sales, who carried this with him always and read it every day. And I have great love and respect for St. Francis de Sales, who wrote many great works. He's a doctor of the church. He wrote The Devout Life and many other good things. So I'd highly recommend this book, The Spiritual Combat. I thought, you know, for a sports kind of program, spiritual combat, you know, it sounds tough. And I thought it would be pretty good. So I thought I'd just read to you a little section from here. And it's really how to combat sloth. That's not a word you hear about much, you know. You might have heard there's an animal called a sloth. Well, I guess part of it came from the fact that, you know, sloth, that we move so slowly and we do so little and we, you know, work towards our own ease, and that's kind of being slothful. So I'm not going to read you the whole thing. I'm going to sort of jump in here, but I'd encourage you to go read it. And I'm just going to give you a little bit of it. So I'm going to start here. It's difficult to shake off the habit of sloth once it is acquired, unless shame accompanies this indolent life and rouses us to greater diligence and application. Sloth, moreover, is a poison that spreads itself through all the faculties of the soul. It not only infects the will by making work odious to it, but it also the understanding by so blinding it that the resolutions of the slothful usually have no effect. What should be done without delay is either neglected or deferred or put to some other time. Mere swiftness of action, however, is not enough. Things must be done at the proper time and in the most perfect manner possible. That's really an important idea there. You know, the proper time and most perfect manner. Not just doing it at the right time, but trying to do it as well as you're capable with all the skills, talents, and abilities you've been blessed with. A precipitous act which is done with no regard for its proper execution, but only to be rid of the trouble and to enjoy peace again as soon as possible, cannot be called diligent. It is rather an artful, refined sloth. This disorder springs from a failure to consider the great value of good work, which is done at the proper time and in correct manner. Such an act overcomes all the obstacles which sloth places before those who enter the battle against their vices. Reflect frequently, therefore, that a single aspiration, an ejaculation, a genuflection, the least sign of respect for the divine majesty, is of greater value than all of the treasures of the earth. Every time a person mortifies his inclinations, the angels present him with a crown of glory as a reward for the victory gained over himself. On the contrary, God gradually withdraws his graces from those who neglect them, and increases the fervor of the diligent souls until at length he introduces them to the joys of heaven. You may at first find your strength insufficient to undergo all the difficulties and troubles that you will encounter on the road to perfection. Then you must acquire the habit of hiding them from yourself. They will appear more insignificant than the slothful are apt to imagine them to be. When an act must be repeated many times in order to acquire some particular virtue, now think of yourselves training and competing and so forth. It takes, you know, repeating things over and over. And this has to be continued for several days or longer in opposition to the countless powerful enemies. Begin to do those acts as though a few would suffice and your trouble would soon end. Attack one enemy at a time as though you had but one to encounter. Be confident that with God's grace you will master them. In all this, you will overcome your sloth and acquire the contrary virtue, which is really what we're trying to do, is that if you're doing a virtue, you can't be doing a vice at the same time. Use the same method in regard to prayer. Now, prayer for all of us sometimes is a difficult thing to do. You know, we feel like, I don't really feel like praying. I don't feel like doing it right now. That's sort of being slothful. If you are to pray for an hour, wow, and the time seems long, begin as though you were to pray but a quarter of an hour. When that is finished, propose another quarter hour, and the hour will elapse imperceptibly. So it's a good idea, and it's the way sometimes to take hard training workouts. You know, you take a piece at a time. You try not to look to the end, because if you do, sometimes you wouldn't even start. If, however, during this period you experience a great repugnance and aversion to prayer, cease praying for a while. In a short time, return again to the prayer that you had interrupted. This is also true in regard to manual labor. If you feel that you are overwhelmed by the amount of work before you and by the difficulties involved, do not permit indolence to discourage you. Begin with what demands your immediate attention and do not think of the rest. Be very diligent, for when this is done well, the remainder will follow with much less trouble than you had anticipated. This is the way to face difficulties. Never hesitate to work. I used to have a little thing. I might sound kind of crazy, but you know, when I was younger and I didn't feel like doing something, I had it in my head that I would just say 1, 2, 3. And at the end of 3, I would automatically stand up and just go do it. So it was kind of like my little activation thing that I did that, you know, when I didn't feel like doing something, I'd say 1, 2, 3. And I kind of felt like, okay, when I say 3, I've got to go. And I sort of trained myself to get up and to do whatever I didn't really feel like doing at the time. So never hesitate to work. There is a good reason to fear lest sloth should triumph within you, that even the first step towards virtue is made impossible, and a horror of work is imprinted in your mind before you have actually experienced the least difficulty in its accomplishment. This is what happens to the weak, cowardly souls. They are in continual dread of the enemy, no matter how weak and remote from them he may be. They are never apprehensive lest more that should be laid down to them than they can bear. Consequently, they have no rest even when most at ease. Realize then that in vice there is a poison, which not only chokes the first seeds of virtue, but even destroys those already formed. What the worm does in the wood, sloth effects in the spiritual life. It is used very successfully by the devil to draw men into snares, particularly those who seek perfection. Guard yourself, pray, and do good. Do not defer making your wedding garment until you are called upon to go forth and meet the heavenly bridegroom. Reflect every day on the fact that he, meaning God, who has granted you the morning, has not promised you the evening. And should he grant this, it gives no assurance of the following morning. Spend each day, therefore, as if it were your last. Cherish nothing but the will of God, for you will have to render a strict account for every movement, or every moment. A final observation should be made. Although you have transacted a great deal of business and have undergone many hardships, you may consider the day worthless and your labors unprofitable unless you have gained many victories over your passions and your own will. Unless you have gratefully acknowledged the benefits received from God, particularly his death on the cross, and unless you have accepted his blessings, whatever chastisements the Father of infinite mercy has inflicted as an expiation for your many sins. So what it's really saying to us is that, you know, it's training your will. It's, you know, it's trying to overcome the difficulties and the snares of the devil in our own life. And hopefully this will be of some value to you. So I recommend The Spiritual Combat. Well, thanks again for another great episode. It's been a particularly enjoyable one for me today. Mark keeps telling me that things flow better after I get going a little bit. And my daughter Mary's here with me today, so that's a special honor and privilege for me. And so I look forward to your feedback and comments. You can call me at our listener line, which is 206-203-1301, or you can write to me at feedback@reclaimthegame.com. And I hope that you'll also go and vote for our Sport the Service of the Spirit Award on the website www.reclaimthegame.com. And I'll look forward to seeing you next time. Take care and God bless.